This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present. Today we are joined by Nigel Kerner, who is the author of Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, The Conspiracy to Genetically Tamper with Humanity, and that is put out by Bear and Company, 2010. It is available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. And Nigel, I'd like to welcome you to Sphinx Radio.
Thank you very much. Greetings to everyone from Oxfordshire in England.
Very good. Now, I want to say I highly recommend Nigel Kerner's book. Primarily what I liked about it, it's certainly interesting what he had to say about his theory of what gray aliens are, but I found the scientific writing to be very reader-friendly. And the difficulty a lot of times when you get into things like DNA or whatever, you have to almost be an Oxford professor to work through it. But Nigel, you did an outstanding job explaining the science behind what you're talking about to the general public, which is not an easy deal. And I suspect you have some background in science. You were so good at it. And
I'm a bit soaked in, I'm afraid, you know, very difficult to get all the traces of it off me.
Right. It's well done, though. You know, it's clear. That's the important thing. So don't be scared away by this book because when you hear terms like DNA, there's not a lot of mathematics. It's explained clearly. Now, I was good friends with John Mack, who lived right near me here in Massachusetts.
Oh, that's interesting, yes.
And we talked a lot about aliens and gray aliens, and his theory was that these people were really being contacted by extraterrestrials. And my theory is I thought they might be demon-like creatures trying to steal people's souls. And you're kind of the middle ground in that kind of thinking. Could you tell us how you came to write Gray Aliens?
Well, it's a long story, and I keep repeating this in all the radio broadcasts I make, but it was really quite a romantic thing. My young kid, Darren, at the time, 12 years old, asked me a question. You know, Dad, are UFOs real? And I'm afraid it was the kind of question that knocked me sideways a bit, because it wasn't really one of my prime interests in life, talking about UFOs and so on. And to be honest, I had no idea what these things were. In fact, I had a kind of, you know, innate suspicion that it might all be, you know, this Buck Rogers business and so forth that we all went through and enjoyed as children and so on. And then finally, you know, out of honoring my boys, he's pretty well-hitched up kid, you know, up top where the gray matter is concerned. And rather than have him embarrass me and come back to me at some later date and embarrass me in front of my friends with my answer and so on, I thought I'd do a kind of, you know, studied response to him. Well, that studied response, you know, Bill, took me nearly 40 years before I was able to give a proper answer that did honor to my son. Kind of thing. And in the meantime, during the course of this research and so on, I was absolutely gobsmacked at what I discovered. And in fact, from being a skeptic, I am an utterly convinced honcho, if you like, as to the veracity of this phenomenon. There's no doubt in my mind that something absolutely sensational is going on our planet today, and unfortunately, most people in the dominion of our lives do not seem to know, at least in the mainstream, it seems to me, or care too much about this kind of phenomenon. I think that's a very, very great mistake indeed. So I wrote the books based upon my research and so on. In fact, there are three of them. The second one is the one you quoted. And it was a painstaking thing, because it all seemed to, when you connected up the dots, it all seemed to kind of hitch together all the great, you know, directions that we all take in philosophy, science, social science, and the kinds of great questions, who are we, what are we, what are we doing here, and all of that, seemed to come out in the wash, so to speak, as I went through the whole thing, and really turned my existential beliefs to upside down, and it's a good thing too, because I was there like everyone else, naively following all the nonsense that we'd been taught when we were children and so forth, as is the way of things, you know. Now, I have to say that in my background, I'm not a very religious person. I do have no real love for organized religion of any sort, but when I was a youngster, you know, just out of the cradle, so to speak, somebody splashed some water on me and called me a Roman Catholic. I did my best to buck against it and never got to the age where I had to kiss the bishop's ring and say, yeah, take me on board kind of thing. And so we went from there to science. My family's background's in science and so forth. I love the old looking through a test tube thing and proving things logically, you know, making sure that I don't sell people a bill of goods. They can themselves. The lovely thing about the scientific ethic is that it's empirical, and people can actually repeat it and see things for themselves and configure it in a very logical, systemic way.
Very fascinating, Nigel. Now, what exactly do you believe these gray aliens are, and why are they tampering or bothering to tamper with human beings if they are clearly in many ways more sophisticated technologically than we are? Why would they bother with us?
Yeah, very, very good question indeed, obviously, and it's the obvious question to ask. Why are these things that have left traces many thousands of years ago on, in terms of petroglyphs and so on our planet, why are these things lingering here? What on earth would they be doing for such a length of time? And how we'd know about them, obviously, in all their time. Why is it that we don't know about them? Why are they seem ostensibly to be operating in secret? Why are they abducting people and doing the most cruel experiments on them, leaving mental scars that go on for a lifetime? If they were beneficent and benevolent and so on, surely they could come and take us by the hand and gently lead us into a new dawn, so to speak, and give us all this information, transform our lives and whatever. Oh no, they're not doing that. They seem to be hiding. What's even more threatening is that people seem to be hiding. That's not answering your question, of course, and taking a snatch at what they are. And common to everyone else, I don't really know empirically what they really are, but one can take an educated guess. If you've studied the subject for as long as I have, I think I have at least the opportunity to be able to talk about it with a bit of informed judgment about it, or observational capacity about it. Now, just to answer your question, William, let me say this. You know, we seem to be steadily moving towards the transformation of our natural humanity into an artificial version. Our progress, you know, is towards what I call SIM card man, and this seems to be accelerating. The implantation of chips in the human body is gaining acceptance, be it for the enhancement of intelligence or memory, or as a type of medical alert bracelet, shall we say, planted in the hands or the wrists, so that if you found unconscious, you'd be scanned and your medical history brought up. All things ostensibly worthy, it seems. And in the recent years, there are reports that NASA and General Motors, actually, are just putting the finishing touches on a project to send robots into space with astronauts, you know. The robots would eventually be left, you know, kind of like caretakers to run longer-term experiments. Now, my question is this, after looking at this thing 6 ways to Sunday, could the gray aliens themselves be the final product of a civilization at another location in the universe, shall we say, achieving a similar stage of technological advancement and then carrying it on so far that the natural body is transformed through kind of artificial implants into a biomechanical artificial entity, a roboid, a highly sophisticated roboid, one the product of many thousands of years of scientific and technological development, whereas ours is, what, just a mere 200, I think, since the steam engine was invented, or it's only 1905 that the Wright brothers took off above the ground, so to speak, in an aircraft, whatever, you know. And here we are. We have the most distinguished people insulted by the mainstream, called liars and misinterpreters and so on, of a phenomenon when in fact they are highly trained, skilled individuals. You know, I refer, of course, to the Washington Press Club recent meeting with many, many distinguished Americans who stood testament, courageous people who went out there and said, enough is enough. These things are here. Why are they here? Who is hiding them? Why are you calling us fools? We are, you know, we are entitled to some respect. We're not stupid. We really don't, you know, don't want to do this. We're, you know, sticking our necks out. Somebody come out there in the know, so to speak, and answer this thing definitively. If these extraterrestrials are here and they have a technology so superior that it brings them across the universe, past the ceiling, the Einsteinian limit of the speed of light, so to speak. What are they doing here? If not to have some motivation to amalgamate with us, if so, why haven't they done this over these thousands of years and so on? And so, you know, there's this big conundrum up in the air for everyone on this planet to consider, and nothing in the mainstream is making any real noise about it. When in fact, you know, I often use this example in interviews, but it's true. If our, say, British royal family has a toothache, they're on the front page. But something is enormous, of such enormous consequences to the body politic of humanity itself, as an alien factor or factorization of perhaps our humanity, or whatever it is denied, is thrown away. And when you look at the evidence and you look at it, 1 + 1 = 1 + 1, you see beyond a shadow of a doubt that these things seem to have sponsored genetically our species way back thousands of years ago, and we may be a kind of lab rat on which experiments are done because they have discovered something about us that is absolutely amazing that they don't have as robots. Now, as robots, they would be programmed, and we know that program is all a robot can know. In fact, a robot can never have a sense of I or meaning in terms of the self. No way. And so, what are these things there persisting with a living species? A species, incidentally, kind of come in with the universe. We would have had to. We've got dad, mum, granddad, great-granddad, and so on, going back in a line to the very beginning of the universe. And we, as natural living species, have an attendant line, a descending line from the beginning of the universe, so to speak, to now. Now, that is an incredible schematic, and that particular thing makes us have something extremely important. We have natural life. We can live, and if they're very intelligent, they can observe this. We can die, they can observe the same. And if indeed, as all the major religions once believed, there is a capacity for us to transmogrify, come back in another lifetime with the same capacity we had before, you know, we call that reincarnation. And obviously, I've been a great skeptic about this for many years of my life until I actually studied what it might be. I'm absolutely and thoroughly convinced now that the ethic of reincarnation is true, that we do, in fact, continue and come back until something about us changes our own aspect by a kind of sense of mind over matter, thinkability, call it what you like, and so on. So I then had to look at my entire schematic of existence, so to speak. What does being there actually mean? What are we? And you know, the strange thing is, when you hitch all that together and you connect up the dots, you find an amazing correlation with what UFOs, believe it or not, bizarre though it might seem, UFOs and religion. And, of course, religion then ties up to the exponencies of the great teachers and so on and so forth. And here was religion coming back again, when as a scientist we're doing our level best to get rid of it. So we then get this mechanism that connects up to what might be a factorization we call God, for want of a better word. We make it anthropomorphic, and we make God into a figure like a robber baron that has jealousies and envies and is partial to particular types of being and people and whatever and so forth, and not something loving and all-pervasive that is totally neutral and allows us this incredible capacity for free will and so forth and so on, which I believe it ought to be. So I had to go back to square one and kind of rewrite the book to accommodate this if I was really serious about how I hitched this all together with simple derivative logic, if you see what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah.
Oh, it's quite a wonderful book and very, as I said earlier, clearly written. Now, you have a wonderful set of ideas in there. You talk about what Jesus might have been and what Hitler might have been. So you tie this in historically in a really wonderful way. And one thing, I'm a true crime writer. I write about serial killers. And what we're discovering about these evil people through biology is, to use a colloquialism, they have a screw loose or a genetic problem. You know, they're neurologically different from people who don't kill or mass murder or anything of that nature. And they're even looking at, you see all these drugs they're trying to give them to correct their brain chemistry. Would you tie that into your theory in any way?
Look at it this way, Bill. Here, this kind of entity happens on our planet. You know, if you find that difficult to believe, just recently we have science affirming, and this is on the record, science affirming that there might be 100,000 planets, Earth-like planets, in our galaxy alone. And that's based on evidence, evidentially quantified and qualified by good scientific minds, and true. Now, if that's the case, let me tell you, do each of those planets have a version of a god? Plus, how many gods would there be, if you see what I'm trying to say?
Sure.
So we've got to try to find a mechanism that accounts for this idea of God. And I think I tried to look at some way that I could come at this, some fair, neutral kind of way, and I discovered that, yes, there may well be a way of looking at it, that there is maybe something that is like our reality, but quite opposite to what is happening in our reality. Let me explain that. We have in physics what we call the second law of thermodynamics. No need to get scared about it. All it simply says is that everything is going from point to point into decay. Everything seems to go one way. Everything rocks, Bill. Absolutely everything. Why is it one way? Isn't that curious? Because in the ordinary way of thinking, there's always a plus and a minus. There's a yin and a yang, a positron and an electron. There's two things that are two capacities between which you have a continuum constructed. Yet, if you look at the overall momentum of the universe, as science verifies today, Bill, science says that one day this universe will end in a cold, dark nothingness. With all our thinking and feeling and understanding and all the things we reach and dream for and all the rest of it, anomalous nothing, everything unwound, every scientific atomically derived particle unwound into a cold mass of nothingness. In other words, it's finite. However, in the religious sense, there were great, wonderful beings, and I remember, and I may be very much against organized religion, but I do believe in the great authors of those religions, and amongst them, in doing my research, in trying to explain the grace aliens, I happened in on this phenomenon, the Shroud of Turin, and this individual they call Yeshua ben Yosef in Judaic law, Jesus Christ to you and me in the Christian sense, and so on. And I tell you what, it blew my mind when I actually went up to the books that aren't actually included in the Christian code, the common Christian codex, looked at the Nag Hammadi, the Pistis Sophia, and all the other things that were thrown away in the past, and that this then spoke of a being that was an absolutely phenomenal scientist. And when you look at this the scientists who are trying to get rid of him as a God figure will have to come back and say, I tell you what, but what's happened on that piece of cloth in that scaled in the Turing Cathedral is a phenomenon that defies 21st or 22nd century science, perhaps, because something absolutely enormous happened in a little sepulcher there when a individual glowed brighter than the sun for a nanosecond and burnt the very surface of this piece of cloth with distance-coded information that could be retrieved, you know, in three-dimensional aspect by requisite machinery today, and to show us that there's something extraordinary maybe about the human prospectus form. Now, people might say he's a god, he could do that and we couldn't. But you know, he never claimed that himself. He simply said that one day we all could do this. And when I saw that this man was trying to say to us, hey, you human beings have an absolutely outstanding power here, that if you do things right, if you think right, the things that make you solid in this universe would be unwound and evaporated, and you glow bright and perhaps go to another universe that, unlike us, is not rotting, where everything goes back the opposite way into a whole singularity, where all information is contained in one, so to speak. And in that state, you would live forever. You would be an eternal entity, your individuality submerged into this vast oneness, and you would live in individuality and this overall oneness at the same time. And that's how he would vindicate in the end, even at the cost of death. He would vindicate himself into a situation that provided for us the evidence that we might be something so special that the greys, these alien-type machines that have happened in on us, sent by some other planet, might well want for themselves. Because you see, as machines, as being physical, they would decay with the second law of thermodynamics. But here is a relatively primitive hominid that is doing this trick of living, dying, and coming back again. Now, how could they get a bit of this action? How could they piggyback on this mechanism, if you can see what I'm trying to say? That is surely worth waiting for and trying to make happen for themselves and so on. And I believe that ever since then, they've been developing us with their technological aspect to bring themselves into our being like a piggybacking mechanism so that they then could continue on and have an eternity that does end with the universe themselves. And that is something I think worthwhile staying anywhere for. And in as much as that might be so, maybe we have something there that we all should look at.
Very fascinating stuff, Nigel. Now, I don't know if these beings or whatever they are would be able to do that, but they're making an effort to do so, and it's quite frightening.
See, Bill, I think these are the things we've mistaken in the past for demons of old. You know, I don't think this business about demons and all this, that's too contrived. It's ephemerality. I mean, one can actually rustle up anything we want in those terms. But we could actually look and prove the ancestral lineage and line of this kind of thing we call the greys and so forth. They are manifestable and painted themselves, you see what I'm trying to say. They have been discussed. Yeah, sorry. You were going to say something, I think.
Oh, no. I would go on. That was quite interesting. Sure.
Yeah. I know I'm a very good friend of mine and an absolutely brilliant man in his research. Nick Redfern has discovered a group in the United States called the Collins Elite, apparently, that believes that the greys are demonic deception created by occultists and so forth. Well, I think we've got to explain the paradigm of life against the paradigm of death. And if we can do this, I see the soul as that information that each one of us has in a line, you and me, that comes from the beginning of the universe. Now, that is the most precious and wondrous element, really, that we all have an information line that ends in our individuality, and that this information line is quite simply what I would call a soul, you know, and that this information line, hitched to their program, line of information the way they gather it, with a kind of compound additive intelligence, quantum intelligence, if you like. If they could merge the two things, then they could intercept us, our individual lines, and the terrible thing is, probably intercept our mechanism to an eternal life.
Oh, amazing. So you think they might be able to do it?
And if they do that, each individual is in big trouble, Bill. And so that's why it's taken so many pages in that book to meticulously list the evidence and to see this whole thing as sequentially as we can. And, you know, I don't really want to preach new meanings to the world at all. I simply want to give my son the best information I can to his simple question. You know, he started all the trouble. Dad, are UFOs real? And I tell you, wow, what I was I surprised at what I was researching and what I was getting and so on.
Oh, it's really, that's a wonderful adventure. Listen, we're about out of time. I want to give out the name of the book once more. People can get it at Amazon. It's Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, a Conspiracy to Genetically Tamper with Humanity 2010, and it's put out by Bear & Company. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And do you also have a web page out there that people could get more information?
It's simply nigelkerner.com. That's all.
Nigel with a K, Nigel Kerner.
Yes, Nigel, N-I-G-E-L, Nigel, K-E-R-N-E-R.com. Simply that. I mean, you know, in the English sense, I'm rather embarrassed about touting my own work or whatever. But, you know, I wrote the book for the new generation, to ask the children to take a look, the new ones coming along. You know, you and I, we probably will discover the truth of all of this thing not so far in. I hope you live much longer, you know, but I would say that there is obviously a finite sense to our living being. And the new ones are coming along, wide-eyed and legless, so to speak, not knowing where they're heading. Religion has been taken away from them. Science is giving them contradictory information all the time and so forth, and they're bewildered. And I try to put this and post this on their behalf, and I hope that somewhere along the line, the clever, intelligent people might probably take this on and make something better of it than I've done so far. But it's my attempt to try to give them a gift for the future, so to speak, you know?
Oh, very good, Nigel. And will you come back and give us an update if there's any more information, especially on the Shroud of Turin and things like that?
I would love to do that, Bill. And I've got a very good friend of mine. I hope you'd invite along the way Dr. Andrew Silverman, who gave a fantastic dissertation at the Frascati Conference doing the research. Top scientists in the world. All the best talking about this incredible artifact. And I tell you what, if this artifact is what I think it is, it will turn all our heads completely round and give us the most awesome sense of hope for the future if we can just love being human and love each other.
Very good, Nigel. We're going to go for now. Thank you very much for being on Sphinx Radio.
Thank you so much, William. Bye-bye.
Okay, we're all set. We're off air now. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay. Wonderful. Bye-bye.
All right. I'll put this up on Monday, okay?
Thank you very much.
And I'll email it to your assistant.
Thank you so much.
Very good. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.